Hi, it's the Philosopher's Zone, and today, why do it in public?
Speaking of Nietzsche again, there's this famous Nietzsche quotation where he says that what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And I know a lot of people who find that thought very comforting. I once met someone who had a tattoo of it because she found it so comforting. She wanted to see it every day. And I think that has a kind of therapeutic content which speaks to people. On the other hand, I don't think it's right. There are lots of things that happen to us which don't kill us and don't make us stronger. If you're being a philosopher in the sense that I understand the term, it has to matter to you that that's not true if you agree that it's not true.
Nothing like quoting Nietzsche, even if you don't understand him. Perhaps that's the price of taking philosophy to the streets. Because, as some argue, if it isn't practiced in public, it will fulfill Stephen Hawking's diagnosis that philosophy is dead. That's a real dilemma for Laura D'Olimpio, a philosopher with one foot in the academy and one planted firmly in the world.
The space for the public intellectual is only fairly recently starting to be explored and filled. There are only a couple of world-famous philosophers in this space, and arguably those would be Peter Singer, Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris, and Alain de Botton. With this list, I obviously exclude many great thinkers, who academic philosophers would count as the greatest living philosophers working today. People such as Martha Nussbaum, Noam Chomsky, David Chalmers, and Sol Kripke. We've recently lost Hilary Putnam, more's the shame. But also, by including the name Alain de Botton on that list, I invite a backlash. Can philosophy be made accessible to a wide general audience who have not studied philosophy without watering it down and losing the very essence of its carefully constructed and painstakingly justified arguments? If we take philosophy out of the academy, does it become pseudo-philosophy? Or is it possible that philosophy can be done at varying levels of skill and competence that need not be antagonistic to the philosophical research and teaching done by philosophers within the university setting? Pragmatically, I'd like to defend both approaches to doing philosophy, and I don't see why they can't support and supplement one another. As a philosopher who is employed within a philosophy department at a university, who also regularly contributes to such public philosophy spaces as The Conversation and, of course, The Philosopher's Zone, as well as running occasional philosophy cafes, it will not surprise you that I take this stance. Yet I also understand the tension our first guest feels when, having engaged philosophically with the general public, you're sometimes left feeling frustrated that the go-to approach taken by many is one of relativism. Under the guise of tolerance and inclusiveness, people often merrily reply to divergent beliefs with, well, you believe what you want, but I have my own opinion, which shuts down the dialogue as opposed to furthering it. And there is always one person who just wants to soapbox their cause, and that can make facilitating a dialogue hard work. Mind you, this can also occur in a university philosophy class. Philosophers are generally fairly bad at publicising what they do and advertising philosophy as a discipline. The writing style favoured by academic philosophers is notoriously obtuse and so often only designed to be read and understood by those few other philosophers working in one subject area. This may explain why the public can lack an appreciation for the role of philosophy in the 21st century and why some prominent scientists have come out and informed whomever will listen that philosophy has done its dash by giving rise to scientists themselves and is now redundant, having been superseded by this new brand of natural philosophers. Of course, scientists who think there is no work left for philosophers to do are just wrong. And usually philosophers are cautious when making big claims, particularly given that we're trained to seek out counterexamples to our own position. There is important philosophical work to be done, including exploring and theorising about metaphysical claims. Claims that ask the big questions about the meaning we make of life, the universe, and everything. It is not just philosophers who do this work, but the skills involved in philosophy are precisely suited to this work. The questions are huge. Is there a God? Do we have free will? How should we live our lives? Is there an essential self or human nature? And yes, philosophers have these unique skill sets that could be of great use in public as well as academic forums. But perhaps some think otherwise.
I'm Tom Stern. I'm a senior lecturer in philosophy at University College London.
One of his specialties is Nietzsche, a thinker who can be notoriously opaque while also being incredibly popular.
Nietzsche's a funny example because I think so much of the appeal of Nietzsche, and rightly, is that people pick up a book of his and start reading and immediately feel as though they understand what he's saying. He has a kind of style which, although quite difficult to understand in some places, tends to make people think that he's just talking to them. It's a style which, it's as though he's saying, look, it's you and me against the world, or you and me, we've seen through things, we've understood this thing that no one else has understood, and let's talk just between ourselves. And that style, I think, is very seductive in a certain way. Mm. And I don't want to say that it's a bad one, because it's been so successful. I also think that Nietzsche's a philosopher that it is very easy to misunderstand, but also for the reasons I've mentioned, he writes in a way which lends himself to misunderstanding. And we have to ask what's wrong with misunderstanding a philosopher. I mean, if I think I've understood Nietzsche right, which of course I might not have done, but if I do, and you read Nietzsche and you misunderstand Nietzsche, well, it hasn't really done any harm to Nietzsche. He's dead, and it hasn't done much harm to me. I've got my own understanding. So misunderstanding a philosopher but thinking you've understood him isn't a particularly big crime. I think where my concern lies is that misunderstanding can often arise because somebody hasn't put in the effort to understand a philosopher. And that's when I begin to get more suspicious, and this applies not just to Nietzsche but to lots of other philosophers, because so much of philosophy is about putting the time in and the effort in to understand complex, challenging and slightly awkward ideas. And so I worry that if somebody just reads Nietzsche and finds that Nietzsche seems to agree with what they already thought, and that it's all nice and good and it fits in with their worldview in general, then I'm suspicious that they haven't put in the effort to do the difficult thing of really trying to work through the philosophical ideas. But as I say, that's a slightly different thing from me being upset because they've just misunderstood him. That's not so much the worry. I think you can't expect an academic study of a philosopher that helps you really understand what, say, somebody like Kant or Hegel or Nietzsche said. I think you can't expect that to make you something like a wise person, or, you know, I think that it wouldn't necessarily be the case that somebody who'd studied those philosophers carefully and understood their ways of thinking, if somebody, one of their friends from outside philosophy, came along and said, I've got this dilemma, I need your help, I think you wouldn't necessarily expect that person to be wiser than anybody else. Of course they might be, but my point was, you can't expect studying philosophy to have that effect on you. When it comes to something like the School of Life, I'm very glad that there's a public interest in philosophy, and I think it serves to remind us that people like and are interested in the things that philosophers have to say. And I think sometimes we find ourselves in an environment in the arts and humanities or social sciences where we feel the need to justify ourselves, and it's very reassuring that there is this interest. I think the School of Life, in as much as I've seen it, has an emphasis on philosophy as a kind of therapy. And my only worry about that is that in addition to being a kind of therapy, or in addition to having this therapeutic element, I think philosophy has to have a rigorous truth-seeking element to it. And it's quite possible that the things in a philosopher that someone found therapeutic would be things that weren't true. I'll give you an example. So speaking of Nietzsche again, there's this famous Nietzsche quotation where he says that what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And I know a lot of people who find that thought very comforting. I once met someone who had it, a tattoo of it, because she found it so comforting. She wanted to see it every day. And I can exactly see why that's a comforting thought, because it suggests that anything that happens to you that's not deadly, that strikes you as unpleasant or adverse, any horrible experience you have, you're going to come out of it stronger. And I think that has a kind of therapeutic content which speaks to people. On the other hand, I don't think it's right. There are lots of things that happen to us which don't kill us and don't make us stronger. If you're being a philosopher in the sense that I understand the term, it has to matter to you that that's not true, if you agree that it's not true. And so that's an example where I think therapy and truth go in different ways. And my worry with something like the School of Life sometimes is that you lose sight of the true bit and you just focus on the therapy bit. While it's probably true that most people ask questions, or lots of people, many people ask questions or have thoughts that philosophers spend more time thinking about, what philosophy as a professional or as a time-consuming process can offer you, I think, is space and time to think about these things deeply. And then there's, of course, the question, you know, well, why should these particular people be the ones who get to do that rather than those particular people? And that seems to me to be a different question. But it can be true that everyone's a philosopher in the sense that everybody asks these questions. I don't think it's true that everyone's a philosopher in the sense that everybody's given those questions the time and the space that perhaps they need to make a bit more progress in them. So philosophy, it seems to me, gets some of its power and some of its problematic character from not quite knowing whether it's something like an art or something like a science. And one of the things that first drew me to philosophy was that I didn't quite know which one of those things I was more interested in, and this seemed like a way to pretend that I didn't have to make the choice. Mm. And in as much as something is an art, you know, if you go to a gallery, you know, you might like one painting and I might like the other painting, and we can have a conversation about who likes which one, but there's no final settling on that question. I think for some philosophers, philosophy looks like the science, and for some philosophers, it looks like the art. I think for all of us, it can't just be a question of personal preference or personal choice. It has to offer something more than just, oh, you know, you like the sound of Schopenhauer and I like the sound of Nietzsche, and that's really all there is to it. And then the question, of course, is what's the extra thing that it offers? If public philosophy were to turn into just a matter of personal preference in the way that taste is said to be a matter of personal preference, then I think we would have lost something, yeah.
A cautious note, courtesy of Tom Stern of University College London. On the Philosopher's Zone today, Laura D'Olimpio on philosophy for everyone.
Matthew Beard is a moral philosopher who is the writer and content producer at the Ethics Centre in Sydney. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone, Matt. Can you tell me why you think philosophers such as yourself spend so much time encouraging their colleagues to make their work accessible to a general audience?
I think there's probably three reasons that I can think of why this might be happening, and each of them kind of speaks to a different aspect of philosophy. The first one, I think, is a moral argument, which is that academic research and the ability to engage in the speculation around ideas is a privilege. It's not something that everyone has the opportunity to engage in. But underlying a lot of philosophers' research, and I say a lot because not all might agree on this, is the idea that the examined life is essential to part of what it means to be a human being. But if we think it's crucial that people live a life that's examined and yet understand that the tools of examination are in some way a privileged resource, then it seems to suggest a moral imperative to try to disseminate those. So that's the moral argument. There's also a kind of historical argument, which is that a lot of the origins of philosophy lay in teaching and in communicating with other people. If we look at one of the kind of archetypal philosophers in Socrates, he walked and he talked. He didn't write anything down. He engaged in conversation with people who felt themselves to have a question that they needed to have answers, and he served as a bit of a social prompt for them. So this passion for teaching and pedagogy, I think, sits at the heart of what philosophy is. And connected to that, I think, is the idea that starts in Aristotle, which is that philosophical questioning itself begins in a sense of wonder and curiosity. And sometimes philosophers who have been in the academy for a long time can lose that sense of wonder in the grind of philosophical research and engaging with other philosophers. And the curiosity that sits outside of the academy with people who haven't trained in philosophy can, I think, sometimes be really refreshing and beneficial for philosophers.
Yes. Do you think that philosophers have almost forgotten that philosophy, Socrates, started in the streets with him walking around and talking to people? And in this idea of, well, why should philosophers come out of the academy? It's almost this forgetting that, well, we weren't always just in the academy.
There's an irony, I think, in that philosophy, if anything, is the process of reflection and ensuring that the things that we do and the way that we live is examined and based on good reasons and good arguments. But there has been this general acceptance that philosophy's natural home is in the academy. And that wasn't the case for the majority of the history of philosophy. Philosophy has lived outside of the academy through various different forms. And Socrates is the Western example in the street. You know, in the East, we have sort of the Buddha reflecting under a tree. These are markedly removed from the academy. And I think that is something that's worth holding on to when we either approach philosophy within the academy in our teaching context to try to avoid some of the jargonistic language, but also to encourage people to step outside of what's called the ivory tower and actually just engage with people in their own space and on their own terms.
So do you think that this means that everyone and anyone, even if they haven't studied any philosophy, can do philosophy and are in some sense just natural philosophers?
This is a really, really interesting question. I guess it depends a little bit on what we mean when we say the word philosopher. If we go and break down the term and look at the origins of the words, philos and sophia, which underline philosophy, then a philosopher is just someone who loves wisdom. And there's a really interesting conversation we could have about whether we live in a society where people genuinely love wisdom. Another way that we could think about a philosopher is someone who asks philosophical questions. And in that sense, again, we could ask how many people actually do ask philosophical questions. And a third way of looking at it would be that a philosopher is someone who uses the tools of philosophy as an academic discipline as a way of understanding their place in the world. Now, on any of those measures, we will come across some people who do or do not fit that description, whether or not they've studied philosophy. But I think what's important is that every single person can be any one of those things. Any person can be shown to love wisdom. Any person can be introduced and engaged with philosophical question. And any person can learn the tools of philosophy given the opportunity. And that makes sense to me because philosophy is, like any academic discipline and like any human pursuit, a reflection of humanity. And so in some sense, there is something fundamentally human about philosophy. And so any person who appears to be doing something philosophical may well just be reflecting some function of their humanity, which is consistent with philosophy.
But it seems as if the philosophy done in the academy and the philosophy done in the streets is surely of a very different kind. Do you think that the roles are both equally valuable? And do you think they support each other at all?
I think we can look at an analogy to other disciplines, and probably the most obvious one is science and science communication. There are researchers who work purely on very complex, very academic applications of science, and then there are other people who will try to translate that work for the public. And that science communication project has had varying levels of success, but there's quite a clear model there that there are some people who do the scientific research, and then there are other people who communicate to the public and have that passion for science, but also have that ability to translate it and communicate really well. So there's a different skill set there. There could be an analogy there, but I think that there's also a sense in which philosophy is slightly different to science, because I think at the heart of philosophy is this idea of reason and conversation. And that by its very nature involves someone else to be speaking to. And so there is a sense, I think, in which academics can't purely focus on academic research, but have to be in conversation with other people. Now, they might be in conversation with other academics, and I think that's consistent with the ethos of philosophy. But I think that if academic research in philosophy was to move too far away from that idea of conversation and dialogue, we would be seeing something that was not the entirety of what philosophy has usually been and what we've usually seen in some of those archetypal philosophers we've been talking about.
And you've spoken about how there's a moral imperative for philosophers to help in the public spaces to clarify ideas, to bring light to discussions and continue important public debates. And so this might be a service that philosophers can actually play in the public spaces. Do you think that doing that work also helps the philosophers themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, is that if we were to set aside the moral argument and focus purely on self-interest, there are benefits to philosophers from coming out in the public. I think any person who has ever taught philosophy to a student or supervised research will say that if you can't really quickly and eloquently describe what you're trying to do, you might not understand the concept well enough yourself. And I think the ability of trying to explain some of these really complex concepts about epistemology or the ontology of being or the nature of justice, being able to put those into a 15-minute radio show or a public talk that's available for everyone or an 800-word opinion piece, that refines your understanding of the idea because it gets you to what's really important.
As philosophers who work in public spaces, I think you and I are assuming that there is an important role for philosophers in helping to continue the dialogue. But why do you think that there is this perception of philosophy as useless? There's been some prominent scientists who have come out and said that philosophy isn't very worthwhile at all, and there seems to be this general perception that philosophy is outmoded or outdated in some way. Why do you think this perception exists?
I'll suggest something controversial. I think partly it exists because it has, to an extent, been true. And the reason it's been true is because people only get sound bites of philosophy written in its purest form. So when you speak to someone who's never heard of philosophy before, they can recite Descartes' I think, therefore I am, but they don't understand the context from which that comes from. So they can come across as these pithy sound bites, and you know, they might have heard stories of medieval theologians discussing how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But there hasn't been a tradition of philosophical communication for quite some time. And so there have only been pure forms of academic philosophy that the public has stumbled across, and they've taken that to be representative of the discipline as a whole. And that would be like me coming across a journal article about atomic physics and trying to interpret that and see the relevance of that. I can't make sense of it. It seems jargonistic, it seems heavily loaded, it seems highly removed from ordinary life. But when someone's able to communicate how that science is relevant and how it applies to me, I understand it and I see why it's worthwhile for that research to be undertaken. I don't think there's been an equivalent in philosophy to actually show how discussions about ontology, how conversations about epistemology really trickle down and can affect the way that we live our lives every day.
Moral philosopher Matthew Beard. Have you heard him on the hit podcast Short and Curly, where young people wrestle with real-life ethical issues? If you haven't, look it up soon. And now to the final word.
When it comes to philosophy, it is a shame that philosophers have to defend their subject in terms of its use, value and relevance. Recent calls are being made by philosophers to better advertise their discipline area. At the same time, spaces for public philosophy are starting to open up. The BBC has launched a new program called The Global Philosopher with Michael Sandel from Harvard University. Websites like the Daily Nous and magazines such as The New Philosopher write in an ordinary language to bring philosophy news and ideas to a wide audience. Philosophers are working in a climate of research funding cuts, the prioritisation of industry links, and the commodification of a university education that sees students as fee-paying customers. In an era of commercial capitalism, philosophy has a hard time pointing to key performance indicators and utilitarian ends that are guaranteed to result from the study of philosophy. And this is particularly true of the question, what kind of job will you get at the end of it?
Laura D'Olimpio, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, WA, with today's program. More from Laura on this topic on our page. Thanks also to Katie Silver in London, collecting the thoughts of Tom Stern. Production today by Diane Dean and Michelle Watts. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you again in The Zone.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Fran Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.